Hi, I'm Mitch.
And I'm Mel. This is Policy Talks.
Welcome to Policy Talks, a show diving into all things related to policy analysis in international affairs. Well, as you heard at the very top, we have our wonderful co-host Mel back with us. So let me be the first to say, Mel, welcome back. Happy to have you sitting at the table again for this episode.
Aw, thanks, Mitch. I'm very happy to be back to join you for another great conversation. So today is Remembrance Day, which, as it is every year, was commemorated at Ottawa's War Memorial downtown this morning. It was a large and heartfelt ceremony, and also very cold, but a very important thing, I think, to see and attend and to witness. It's also a very appropriate day for what we will be discussing in this episode.
With the deployment of an effective, and I emphasize effective, international force, can genocidal destruction be brought to a halt?
But since the deal was signed, violence in the region has in fact increased. Yesterday, the Sudanese government rejected a draft UN resolution which called for a 17,000-member international security force to be deployed to Darfur.
The government was crippled, and MINUSTA, the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti, lost key personnel, including its chief and deputy and the head of police. Its headquarters toppled, burying hundreds.
The government of Khartoum has long opposed the idea of a UN security force, depicting it as a front for Western imperialism.
As you just heard in those clips, in today's episode, we're talking about peacekeeping and peacekeeping operations. Obviously, this is an important question in Canadian foreign policy, particularly since August, when the government announced the commitment of 600 troops, up to 150 police officers, and funding of $450 million over 3 years, all committed to peacekeeping operations. And if we think about peacekeeping holistically, I think it's fair to say that it has been traditionally a point of pride in the Canadian identity. Canada has been committed to multilateralism, a key aspect of which is, of course, peacekeeping and UN peacekeeping missions. And looking historically, more than 125,000 Canadian peacekeepers have participated in dozens of international efforts over the past six decades in countries all over the world.
Yeah, and I remember growing up just always having that idea of Canada as a leader in peacekeeping on the international stage, and that's something that's stuck with me from then until now, and I know it's a kind of a big factor in this whole and all this peacekeeping decision making, our perception of what it means for us as a country. And mm-hmm. We'll get into that a little more. That being said, Canada's commitment of personnel to UN peacekeeping has actually dropped considerably since the 90s, notwithstanding a commitment of 450 military personnel that were sent in 2000 to help secure the border between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Canada right now contributes about $250 million each year to peacekeeping with relatively little involvement. As of August 31st of this year, Canada has 112 personnel deployed as peacekeepers.
And this obviously raises a lot of questions about Canada's role in peacekeeping, but before we explore that, I think it's important for us to take a step back and really understand what peacekeeping really is and what it's intended for, especially as we're faced with a growing set of new international security concerns.
Absolutely. And today we are lucky to have a special guest guide us through this topic. David Carment is the full professor of international affairs at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University. He is also a fellow at the Canadian Defense and Foreign Affairs Institute and a NATO fellow, who's listed in the who's who of international affairs. In addition, Dr. Carment serves as the principal investigator for the Country Indicators for Foreign Policy Project. Dr. Carment, thank you very much for joining us today on Policy Talks.
Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Now, before getting into kind of the complexities of this topic and Canada's particular perspective on it, let's start from the beginning. What is peacekeeping?
Well, first off the bat, I would say peacekeeping is something that's evolved over the last 50, 60 years. So it's very difficult to pin down and give you a specific definition. The other thing that's worth pointing out is that peacekeeping isn't something that only the United Nations does. It's something that other organizations, regional organizations, have also done, and they've done it quite well. But in essence, peacekeeping is something that involves a multilateral effort, a number of states contributing resources. They might be troops, they might be civilians, they might be combinations of civilians and troops, to a mission that has a clear and precise mandate for the purposes of resolving or managing a conflict, depending on the scope of that mandate. It would involve a number of important conditions be met prior to the deployment of those personnel, whether they're soldiers or civilians, including the consent of the parties who are engaged in conflict or have been engaged in conflict to agree to the presence of this third party, this multilateral presence on their soil. It assumes that the United Nations or the other entity that is organizing the deployment of these personnel are themselves not vested in the outcome of the conflict. In other words, they are impartial to both the outcome and the process, that they will pursue what we might call an even-handed approach to resolving the conflict and their contribution to that. And it also assumes a form of management, conflict management, where the peacekeepers themselves are not using force or threats of force to compel the belligerents or the conflicting parties to the negotiating table or to do something they don't wish to do. So all that kind of assumes that the parties themselves have already come to an understanding that there's a need for them to have a third party, a peacekeeping presence on their soil to ensure that whatever they've agreed to can be enforced, or at least have the legitimacy of enforcement. It assumes that the parties themselves have already agreed to maybe step away from the battleground and separate themselves physically, so that they can't inflict further harm on each other. And it assumes that the peacekeepers are not there to impose their will on the belligerents, but rather that the parties themselves will abide by the rules that they've negotiated. So in many ways, what peacekeeping does is legitimize the peace process that the parties in conflict have agreed to. It doesn't necessarily have the capacity to enforce an outcome. And that, in essence, is what a full-scale peacekeeping mission would entail. But you can scale that up, you can scale that down. The earliest peacekeeping missions, if we wanted to call them that, were more or less just observer missions to ensure that conflicting parties were abiding by the rules that they themselves have negotiated. Sometimes border skirmishes or border wars that had the potential to escalate into full-scale war between two countries might require an observer group, a small handful of peacekeepers, to determine whether or not the border that they had agreed to was being respected. All this has, of course, changed, and the peacekeeping that your generation has been exposed to is much different than what I've described. So the peacekeeping I've just described to you is really what we witnessed during the height of the Cold War era, and there were a number of reasons why peacekeeping unfolded that way, but one of the primary reasons was that the conflicting parties in many of these kinds of conflicts where the UN was deployed were countries that had the potential to drag major powers or even the superpowers to conflict with one another, being supporters of one side. The potential for a gradual escalation of conflict was ever present, and so peacekeeping in its sort of traditional form evolved as a way of ensuring that conflicts could be, if not resolved, at least managed at the more local level. And then we can project forward and go into a post-Cold War period where we found ourselves scrambling to deal with that kind of approach to peacekeeping, the most important of which was that the model I've just described to you entails primarily state actors who, by virtue of them being members of the international community, signatories for the large part of the UN Charter, have certain constraints placed on them through international law. There are things that they can and cannot do according to international law. There are sanctions that can be imposed on them should they violate those obligations. And as we know, with the end of the Cold War, the unleashing of regional conflict, the breakup of various states, including the Soviet Union, a number of non-state actors emerged, and they were not in the same position to either represent or adhere to the kind of agreements that states themselves were holding themselves to. So then you get into all sorts of questions about whether those basic principles I've laid out for you, consent, impartiality, non-use of force, are even applicable in a situation mm-hmm. where you have ethnic groups fighting one another, armed factions, breakaway groups, rebel groups, narco traffickers, you name it, all mm-hmm. sorts of different players involved who may not either respect the law or have no political political legitimacy to do so.
I just wanted to jump in on something that you touched on a couple of times mm-hmm. In explaining peacekeeping, and it was the question of enforcement, mm-hmm. and the lack of of enforcement in how it is tied to peacekeeping, yeah. and a term that's also been used in conjunction with peacekeeping sometimes is this idea of peace building, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you. Is the term peace building a recognized term, and does that constitute a shift? Does that constitute a difference? Is there a difference between peacekeeping operations versus peace building operations?
Well, there's an obligation under UN Charter law to respect the process of peace building, but its interpretation is fairly narrow because the kind of issues that the UN was facing during the creation of the UN and the charter that evolved from that, they were dealing primarily with countries that were undergoing a process of decolonization, so breaking away and becoming independent, functional states free of their colonial heritage. And there were a number of those countries that the UN was taking responsibility for. So in the context of transitioning states out of a previous era where they might not have had a fully functional government and security apparatus, peace building in that sense made sense. The concept of transitioning countries, and I see peace building as a process that really follows on after a conflict has escalated and then de-escalated, and there's some formal agreement in place. The peace-building concept was more fully developed by UN Secretary General Boutros Ghali, who really was grappling with this question of what to do with these states that emerged in the end of the Cold War, and how to make them fully functional. And it lay alongside the more traditional peacekeeping concept that we've already discussed, and then peace enforcement, which we haven't discussed, which is a slightly different creature, and the real issue is that in many ways the nature of peacekeeping today is so blurred and so multi-dimensional that all three things may be enacted simultaneously. The use of force may find a place in a country where there's also efforts to build and consolidate governance structures as well as bring or reduce poverty and bring development to that country, which is quite frankly not consistent with the way the UN Charter has laid out the practice of peacekeeping. So these are broad overarching terms that sometimes lose their resonance and meaning when we begin to think of how they are actually applied in the real world. Right. But for me, it's the distinction here is peacebuilding requires a reasonable degree of stability and security to be achieved effectively. The consent of the warring factions or the parties in conflict to the presence of a third party, and most importantly, other means by which you can find resolve to respect a process beyond the use of enforcement. security guarantees are one way one can do that, and the UN has provided some degree of security guarantees to individuals who feel that they may compromise their own security by giving up and conceding some of their authority or their military capacity to another faction. So the UN has often taken upon itself the responsibility of providing that security in lieu of the warring factions' ability to do that. It becomes very complicated when you're functioning in a country where certain individuals may not recognize or give you the consent to be there, while other parties may, those who are affected by the conflict and want delivery of humanitarian assistance and so on. We saw how disastrous this could be when peacekeepers try to do multiple things at the same time and you end up working at cross purposes. In a nutshell, if there's no peace, there's no peacekeeping. There's no peace to keep, and anything else beyond that, I think, is going to be very problematic for the peacekeeper and also for the individuals themselves who may be forced to take sides.
Now, Dr. Carmen, you mentioned some of the... I'm just going to shift back a little to that initial process when peacekeeping missions or deployments are being formed. Uh-huh. And you mentioned some of the assumptions and requirements of the parties involved, like neutrality and impartiality. Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned that it's not necessarily the UN doing peacekeeping. There's some regional organizations doing it as well. But let's just say in the context of a UN peacekeeping mission, what does that process look like? Like when a conflict reaches a certain threshold and the UN Security Council decides to form a peacekeeping mission, is there a vote among the Security Council members? Like, how is it decided which countries will be involved with that mission?
Well, you pretty much nailed it on the head. I mean, the question is, at what point does the conflict become such that it's important to the UN Secretaries General and or the Security Council?
Mm-hmm.
There may be an appeal to the General Assembly as well by vested actors to think about becoming involved in addressing the conflict. That call to become involved may go unheeded. It may lead to a second stage in which the Security Council itself may appoint a special envoy to evaluate or determine the degree to which a UN peacekeeping mission or operation, rather, let's call it, and these days they call them peace support operations, and we haven't really talked about that, whether or not there's a reasonable prospects for success and whether or not it's effective as well as appropriate for the circumstances. So even before there's a decision to deploy, there is a little bit of what we call fact-finding.
Okay.
To determine the actual legitimacy of the mission that might be deployed and the degree to which it's likely to be effective. It's only then, after you have done sort of your homework, that the UN Security Council, if it feels necessary, would then begin to think about developing a mandate, again, in close consultation with an envoy that would be deployed to gather up information in advance of actual mission being sent there.
And then let's say when the mission is established as kind of it's decided that it's going to move forward, once they know which countries are involved, I was just wondering, is there kind of coordinated training for the different states involved, or is it each nation simply conducting their own individual training and preparation for this mission they're going to partake in?
Well, even before there's a decision to deploy, I would suggest that, you know, if we're going to be true to the UN Charter, every other avenue would likely be exhausted, including other forms of trying to get the parties to resolve the dispute or the conflict. So
right.
It's not automatic that they would be looking at the deployment of a peacekeeping mission to a particular country. But let's assume for a moment that they would.
Okay.
Then the mandate would determine whether or not the kind of effort required is such that it would be a more traditional peacekeeping mission, whether it's going to be more multidimensional, involve things like demobilization, security sector reform, or it might even be something a little more significant involving breaches of peace or acts of aggression in which there's a desire on the part of the Security Council to actually separate the factions and prevent them from using force to continue their maintain or achieve their objectives. That's a different animal, Chapter 7, Peace Enforcement, narrowly defined within the UN Charter. Chapter 6 doesn't actually specify peacekeeping, the term. But let's assume for a moment we're dealing with a kind of a Chapter 6 mission, at which point then, yes, there's a kind of a voluntary approach to this. There's every UN member state has the obligation, the right, the responsibility to contribute troops in whatever capacity they might be able to a UN mission. In essence, a call goes out for contributions to that mission. Historically, I mean, the earliest missions that were of a sizable nature beyond, let's say, 1,000 would be composed of countries that were seen as being, politically less partial to one party or the other. And I use the term neutrality and partiality differently here. Impartiality means you're not going to favor one side over the other, but you're not necessarily impartial to the outcome. After all, your responsibility is to peace and achieving peace, and that's definitely not a impartial approach. But neutrality, on the other hand, might suggest that you're indifferent to the outcome as well as to the process. So let's assume that there are parties who are selected because they are not seen to favor one side or the other. And in the Cold War, those countries would fall within an even-handed balance selection of countries like, you have East Bloc countries and maybe some more Western-oriented countries. Canada might fall into that latter category. Sweden was a good choice because it was seen as more neutral. But most of the countries, by and large, came from places where they were seen to have well-trained, disciplined forces. So the bulk of them were naturally, or not so naturally, West European or North American countries, save the United States, which was not seen as being capable of delivering a kind of an impartial approach to peacekeeping during the Cold War, nor did Russia extensively, or the Soviet Union at the time, extensively involve itself in these missions. So smaller countries found a niche here for for themselves to play in these kinds of resolutions. That's changed in the last 20 years, of course, where more countries have stepped up to the plate. There are a number of reasons for that. Now, to your question of training, this is absolutely essential because we see varying levels of capability capacity to abide by the rules of peacekeeping, which are quite restrictive. And we've seen some disastrous outcomes as a result of not abiding by those rules in a number of different ways. The number one killer of peacekeepers historically has been poor driving habits. And some peacekeepers who come from countries where you might say they're a little more risk-acceptant of driving, they tend to have more accidents. So there's all sorts of cultural phenomena explaining variations in how peacekeepers approach these kinds of conflicts, including, oddly enough, driving habits. But the key point here is that training is not uniform across all nations. There are a number of important peace support training centers, including one based in Kingston. There are a number in another key one would be the Kofi Annan Center in Accra, Ghana. Canada has been an instrumental player in the development of these training centers. There's the United States as well has been supporting them, the British, of course. Sweden, Turin Staff College, operated by the United Nations, another key player in training peacekeepers and other UN staff. But the key issue here is that there's no overarching training system for all peacekeepers. I think it would be unwieldy. Mm-hmm. So there's an expectation that peacekeepers require a level of discipline and training in-house, and there's some countries that do quite well and other countries that don't.
You've covered a lot. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll have more about peacekeeping with Dr. David Carman.
You're listening to Policy Talks, recorded at CKCU 93.1. For more, go to www.policytalkspodcast.com. All right, so we are back with our guest, David Carment, and we're ready to dive back into our peacekeeping discussion. Now, before we left off, we were talking about kind of the nuts and bolts of UN and general peacekeeping. Now, we're going to kind of shift towards a more specific focus, towards Canada's role within this institution. Although, before we even go to Canada, you know, something very, very important happened earlier this week on Tuesday, and kind of what kind of international policy podcast would we be if we didn't touch on Donald Trump now being the president-elect of the United States of America. And, you know, the U.S. is a significant funder to the U.N. peacekeeping budget. And obviously the U.S. has a very important world influence, and so influence on peacekeeping efforts. So, Dr. Carment, what do you think the impact is here in the peacekeeping realm?
Well, I'm sure if you asked the president-elect about the UN, he would tell you that he could probably see the UN headquarters from his Trump Tower in New York.
That sounds like
Sarah Palin can see Russia from her back porch, and she may well end up being Secretary of State. So there's two frightening prospects there. But truthfully, this is a government that's probably not going to be giving a lot of credence to the United Nations. I think Donald Trump, in his own way, will find how important it is that he used the UN as a platform for speaking to the world, as all presidents do. But my sense is that the United Nations, just like he's interpreted NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is seen as something that is on the margins of American foreign policy strategic interests. As sad as that might be, this more broadly, I think the Trump agenda could throw a wrench into our government's efforts to become more engaged with the United States in strengthening the multilateral frameworks which underpin Canada's interests in the world, establishment of rule of law being primary, but also respect for international institutions, which act as a break on American unilateralism. And we've seen, for whatever reason, a decline in the respect for multilateral institutions, not the least of which has been the United Nations as an organization responsible for the execution of international and delivery of international security, and the privileging of other actors and other actions that have either circumvented or undermined UN activity. So my guess is that Justin Trudeau was betting, as many people were, because the media told us so, that Hillary Clinton would be president. She's seen as someone who's a career expert on the UN system and has served as Secretary of State. None of that's going to happen now. So we may find ourselves looking to more like-minded countries, not the least of which are those in Western Europe, the Germanys of the world, possibly the Brits, even though they are pursuing their own path. And I don't think all the answers for Canada rest in strengthening the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or at least upping our military contributions to that organization. There are still good reasons to pursue a multilateral agenda through the UN, and specifically through peacekeeping. It's just going to be that much tougher.
Mm-hmm. And touching on this, I think what happened on Tuesday, in terms of a change in government from one party to the to another, reflects perhaps in some way and in some reverse way what happened in our most recent Canadian federal election, transitioning from a conservative government to a liberal government. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to the Prime Minister, mm-hmm. Canada is back on the world mm-hmm. stage, or it's taking steps to be back mm-hmm. on the world stage. But is it? You know, I think it's important for us to consider it from a policy perspective, where this government is going. And so if we look at the commitments that have been made from a peacekeeping point of view, you know, we listed them earlier, mm-hmm. the 600 troops up to 150 police officers, mm-hmm. almost $500 million in committed funding over 3 years, all in the name of peacekeeping operations and perhaps a return to greater multilateralism in Canadian foreign policy. Is this, in your opinion, an appropriate choice from a policy perspective to signify that Canada is back?
Well, I think if we were to look only at what this current government has done so far, we would find that there hasn't been much of a disruption in the way in which Canada has engaged the world from the preceding government. I would be hard-pressed to show to you that there is significant transformation other than the largely rhetorical commitments the government has made thus far. But it's only been a year since they came to power, a little bit more than a year, and it's probably too early to say, and we'll know within 3 months where Canada intends to actually put its resources. But for a whole bunch of reasons, including climate change, which we're not talking about, although there is a very interesting link between climate change and conflict in sub-Saharan Africa, which I think this Canadian government will pick up on in its discussion of peacekeeping there. There hasn't really been much to get a sense that this country is, in fact, showing that they're back or they've changed trajectory. In terms of the commitments we've made to Syria and Iraq, for example, shoring up the weak states of the region, not much to go on there in terms of changing trajectories. In fact, I would almost call it Harper light. Nice on the rhetoric side, but not so much different on the substantive side. Where they could find voice and differentiation and is on the peacekeeping agenda. And if you want, I can turn to that briefly and just describe what I think is the rationale for pursuing that particular course of action.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. So, I mean, the argument has been made that there are a number of countries that are vying for UN Security Council seat, not the least of which are some pretty important countries. I think Norway is one of them and Ireland as well. And there's only one seat that's eligible, and Canada would like to have it. Both those countries have shown a lot of capacity to engage in conflict resolution. They've been vocal and outspoken in a number of key efforts. Canada, as you know, has not for the last 10 years. So they've got a lot of work to do if they want to make a case for Canada being selected over those other two countries. Peacekeeping is not only important because it's seen as a contribution to strengthening peace and security in the world, it's also seen as a way of re-legitimizing or revitalizing the UN system. After all, if you're a country that's now agreeing to put 600 Canadian lives on the line, 650 Canadian lives on the line, and have them under the command and control of the UN, that suggests to me that you have sufficient confidence in that organization such that you are going to contribute your own people's potential lives to a mission that the UN would be responsible for. Now think about that. Probably even before you were born, Canada was moving away from UN-led missions to coalitions of the willing or NATO-led missions. So since about the mid-early 90s, Canada was, since the end of the Somali conflict, in which Canada had a UN mission. To be sure, I mean, Canada has made contributions to a number of missions, UN missions in Haiti and so on, but nothing of a sizable contribution that we're talking about here. So significant legitimization is attached to this commitment that Canada is making. And in turn, I think there's an expectation that we're strengthening the UN system, therefore we respect it, but we also want to have a more important role to play. Therefore, we need a seat on the Security Council. Please give us one. I think that's the kind of logic that's being played out here. You can't expect to have a voice at the table unless you ante up some resources and put your people on the line.
Shifting to another possible motivation, yes, Canada's bid for the Security Council seat is playing what seems to be a major role in a lot of our decision making.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a poll conducted in October that found that almost 70% of Canadians actually supported the deployment of Canadian forces on UN peacekeeping missions in active fighting areas. So I'm definitely seeing this as a kind of support that's tied in with Canada's historical reputation as being a leader in peacekeeping. And so how do you think this public perception of Canada as a peacemaker is actually impacting the decision making?
Well, it is a somewhat surprising result, because I would have thought that most Canadians did not equate peacekeeping with the potential use of force or the actual use of force, either to disarm belligerents or actually defend themselves from attacks by belligerents. So the sense that I would have, especially within voters within Quebec, is that Canada would be more pacifist in its approach, one that would be low risk and an engagement in a country where they're less likely to become targets. Once you're faced with the potential of being attacked, then you are almost immediately taking sides. And so the sense of impartiality is lost, because you've chosen, by virtue of defending yourself or having to deliver humanitarian assistance to regions that are blockaded or whatever, you are, and using force to get that humanitarian assistance into that region, you know, you're making decisions about who should benefit and who should be punished by your actions. That's a different animal than what I've discussed previously. If it is the case that Canadians are willing to put other Canadians at risk where there's war fighting, then I guess the question is whether that ultimately is peacekeeping as we understand it. And I think there are other things in which Canada can be involved where there's war fighting. It doesn't have to be a frontline activity, such as training and so on, logistics and communications, and those are things where we've normally excelled. But the real task of war fighting, if that's what it's going to happen, then has to deal with the very sticky question of dealing with terrorist cells that are operating in conjunction with or alongside other armed factions, or are part of the makeup of a country that is considered deeply fragile or failed. And there are a number of countries where Canada might have to do such a thing.
So if we consider the current context, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier, that of course conflict is not a static concept. It continuously evolves, and I think we've seen quite an evolution even from the 90s until today. We've seen quite an evolution in how conflicts are conducted. And that, of course, has an impact on peacekeeping and the effectiveness of peacekeeping operations. Mm-hmm. I have a quote here from an expert panel convened by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in 2015 that reported that blue helmet missions, so peacekeeping missions, quote, lack the specific equipment, intelligence, logistics, capabilities, and specialized military preparation required to handle violent extremism. Mm-hmm. Looking at the UN mission in Mali, mm-hmm. since the end of April of 2013, we've had on record 68 peacekeepers that have been killed by what the UN calls malicious acts. Mm-hmm. This leads me to wonder, is peacekeeping still a viable policy option in the current state of conflict and in the presence of violent extremists in some of these areas? Has it appropriately adjusted or evolved to accurately reflect the change in conflict?
It's a good question. It's more than just hypothetical or even, you know, theoretical. It's been tested time and time again on the ground, and the question I think has been asked for the better part of 30 years, is peacekeeping an anachronism in an era when there's no peace to keep, or an era when there are non-state actors who don't abide by the rules of the game? But frankly, there will always be a place and time for the traditional kind of peacekeeping that I've described to you. And not every conflict requires an alternative solution where you have to knock heads together or use force or defend yourself from malicious acts as you've described them. There will always be a place for resolving conflicts with symbolic intent, where the parties themselves have agreed to the cessation of violence and so on. There are zones of separation between them. We see this, even though the UN hasn't yet been deployed in the Ukraine. There is a OSCE mission, which is what I was trying to allude to earlier, deployed there, that they have a responsibility to ensure that. Or at least report on the facts as to whether the parties are abiding by their agreement to cease violence. But the UN still does many of these kinds of missions. Observe and report back. But bigger point is whether, you know, the evolution of peacekeeping is unending, and whether or not now, given these new challenges we face. In fact, it wasn't just the Secretary General, former Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who raised this, but an entire panel that has been addressing this for almost 15 years. The Brahimi Report took it to task almost 15 years ago, if not more, and how the UN must evolve to address this kind of ongoing problem. I would suggest that he's got it right. I mean, not only is it a capacity or capability problem, but I think it's also a question of whether the UN has the mandate to deal with extremists and the responsibility to deal with such extremists. Is it the responsibility of the international community to take full responsibility for managing or addressing terrorist challenges? And that's something that we haven't really come to grips with, because not every civilian sees these terrorists as someone who is terrorizing them, but only is focusing on external players, the United States, and so on. So there may be even deeper divisions where the international community, through the UN, be seen attacking these organizations. That's why I think they're choosing to steer clear of it. It's not just that they don't have the capability or capacity, but the problems that they may encounter in such countries like Mali may be ultimately visited upon them on their own soil. Think of Bangladeshi peacekeepers who are trying to resolve conflict in Mali or some other country, French, and then they have to deal with their own problems like that at home. So there's a reciprocal effect, which means that now you've sort of spread that conflict beyond the borders of that country where you're trying to make a difference. And in fact, you're being counterproductive. So what's the alternative? You know, Canada said probably no to Mali for the precise reason you've laid out in terms of deployment of a peacekeeping mission. But we know that Canada already has special forces there, and they have been there for quite a while. And their job is to track down and kill terrorists. They're not working alone. They're working with other like-minded countries, France, the Brits, and the Americans. So it's a nasty world out there, and it's not one where peacekeeping is suited for every occasion. But that doesn't mean that we step aside and don't do anything.
Right. So as you mentioned, peacekeeping does, in fact, not sound as peaceful. But yeah, so you've described this kind of environment that we have now that is constantly changing and probably increasingly unpredictable. Imagine
if you can, if you can ever imagine, that Syria finally comes to some termination of violence, that there's an agreement, a ceasefire, perhaps territorial demarcation. Who's going to oversee that process, that long-term process of ensuring that stability is retained, that the country can return to some normalcy, that IDPs and refugees can return to their homes? Now, what makes Syria interesting is that you've got outside players there who don't see eye to eye, Russia being and the United States being two of those key players. And there you have the possibility for some solution which the UN can present to the international community, in which they are involved in providing some level of stability. Would that be the only solution? Possibly not, but it would be contingent on an absolute stable situation where the peacekeepers would not be targets, but rather intermediaries.
Right. So would you say Canada in particular is prepared to effectively contribute to peacekeeping missions in general? And if so, what's the kind of added value that Canada would likely be contributing that's different from other states?
Well, I can either tell you anecdotally or I can give you the... I'll tell you, you know, the best peacekeeper is a well-trained soldier. And claims or assertions that peacekeepers have to be specially trained, I know there's been documentation that we are not ready or capable to do peacekeeping. I understand that peacekeeping has evolved. There are certainly some skills that need to be better developed, I suppose, amongst all of us. And it's not just soldiers who are being deployed. There are also civilians that are typically not part of the toolkit within a military training agenda. But nevertheless, these things can be picked up, and there are, as I mentioned, the Peace Support Training Center. The soldiers I observed doing peacekeeping after the Bosnian conflict were quite capable. They weren't working under UN auspices, but rather NATO, and they demonstrated a level of professionalism that was unparalleled. And I think that's why I would stick to my claim that Canadian peacekeepers, maybe perhaps not all peacekeepers, are ready to go, minor, perhaps save a few tweaks here and there. I know that sounds kind of vague, but we don't have time perhaps to get into some details. Now, let me give you anecdotally the impression I have as to whether Canada can still stake a claim to this. So I did have a chance to go to Sarajevo and travel through in 98 when the Dayton Accord had been signed. It was in place, but it was still shaky, and Kosovo was about to go south, and things were being disrupted. Ethnic Serbs within Bosnia were not happy with the status quo, and Serbia was certainly not happy with the situation in Kosovo or Montenegro. So I and a number of other academics, along with some Canadian Forces personnel, traveled through the region. And what I observed was a Canadian presence there that was unique and very comfortable with a post-conflict peacekeeping presence. They had the confidence, and they knew how to build the confidence of the local population. Unlike what I observed in the American peacekeeping presence was very much one of fear and fear of being targeted and heavily militarized. So the Canadians would patrol the streets on foot and usually in their accompanied by a LAV, but not one that was in any way dominating, whereas the Americans patrolled the streets with M1 tanks and were heavily armed and so on. And they, perhaps rightly so, saw themselves as targets. But it was a different kind of approach to peacekeeping that I think has since evolved in our mission to Afghanistan in particular, where those who were trained and cut their teeth on the conflict in Bosnia tried to do what they knew best in Afghanistan. They did it as best as they could, which is to engage the local population. And they did it well. There were a number of things that were working against them, but to your question as to whether Canada is prepared to do this and whether Canada still has something to offer the world, I think the answer is yes. And so, that's not just something I would say on Remembrance Day or any other day in respecting the military. I do believe that we have a certain attitude that is puts us alongside some of the more established peacekeepers that have been very effective in the last 30 years.
So if we look at this announced commitment in August of the troops and the funding, we're almost out of time, but I wanted you to, if you could, the biggest question now is where are these resources going? If you could quickly provide us with a prediction,
NIPSIA students, I'll direct you to a piece that Professor Rollins and I wrote many years ago, and on this very question: do you pick the easy mission or do you pick the hard mission? Because it's really coming down to a question of whether you re-enter into a world where you haven't been actively engaged for a long time, keeping in mind that our last major contribution to peacekeeping was Somalia. I mean, there have been a number of smaller missions there. Do you come out with a bang and show how effective and important this is to Canada and show success by picking a mission where you're not likely to be a target? One where there's a more or less agreed upon peace process or where the low intensity conflict is there? Or do you go with something that's really tough? Now, we picked a tough mission in Afghanistan, deliberately so, in Kandahar. Granted, it wasn't peacekeeping per se, but it was a tough mission. And we were told by the chief of staff that this was a deliberate decision to show that we had resolve and capability. So taking into account those two questions, I mean, the analytical answer is you pick the easy one, so then you have something credible to build on for the future, and you can go back to your constituents and say, look, we've done it, now we can build on that, now support us even more. So where do you go? There are no easy ones, but there are pre-existing missions where we could make a contribution. I would suggest that the Central African Republic is one such mission where there has been ongoing conflict. But it's also a country desperately in need of world attention for a whole bunch of reasons. There's South Sudan, where I believe we own part of that country in the sense that we were instrumental in making helping that country become independent. We've had a fairly sizable aid presence there. It's a much tougher mission. Peacekeepers have been targeted. Some have been killed. Some have been taken as hostages and so on. Then there's Mali. My sense is the French more or less want to own that, and they may drag the Germans and possibly the Brits in there. Our presence there is not nearly as important as it might be somewhere else where we're more likely to have an impact. In a nutshell, I'm suggesting that sub-Saharan Africa is probably the place that we will focus our attention, but I wouldn't rule out Colombia. We've been in talks with that government in the lead-up to the peace process, and it's a country that could really benefit from a Canadian presence. I think we have a long-standing positive relationship with that country, and it's one that finally could get over the hump. We also have a good relationship with Cuba, compared to the United States, where some of the peace talks are taking place. So there's your outlier. Where else might we see a UN peacekeeping mission? Eventually, I hope, sometime in the Ukraine, but I don't think that will happen in the immediate future with Trump in power, but I'd like to be proven wrong, and our NATO presence there is quite strong. So I'm going to limit it to those three. Some have also said DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's a huge country, one that desperately needs peacekeepers, but it also needs a whole bunch of other things. So my point earlier about being effective and showing impact and demonstrating success is absolutely essential, I think, to this government that really wants to get a seat on that Security Council.
Right. Listeners at home, those are the predictions from Dr. Carmen.
Yeah, I didn't really make one prediction, did I?
Right. Well,
do you have any predictions?
Mitch, do you have any predictions?
You know what? Dr. Carmen, I couldn't agree more. That was exactly what I was thinking.
All right,
Dr. Carmen, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation and for your time and perspective and guiding us through this kind of really massive topic.
Glad we could do it.
Yeah, so that's all the time we have today. Thank you for listening to Policy Talks. Remember to visit us at policytalkspodcast.com and on Twitter at policytalkspod for updates and for related content. So if you have any feedback, comments, or suggestions, Mitch and I and the rest of the team would love to hear from you. We're always open to topic suggestions or opinions that you have any of the podcasts that we've done so far. So send us an email or reach us on Facebook or Twitter.
And of course, speaking of team, these episodes would not be possible without the hard work of those of us not behind the microphone. So we want to thank our research team who put this together, Devin Wallanius, Bridget Healy, Kenneth Boddy. We also want to thank our technical crew, Samran Roy and Megan Boisjoli. And of course, we also want to thank our producer, Joe Venkatesh. Until next time, I'm Mitch.
And I'm Mel. This is Policy Talks.